The birds sing to delight in the first fine days of the fall, in the warm, hazy light. Robins, bluebirds, in families on the almost bare elms, phoebes, and probably purple finches. Now the year itself begins to be ripened by the frost, like a persimmon.
You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is vocalist and composer Joan LaBarbera, who, from February 8th to 10, 2013, was among the guest collaborators with Michael Tilson Thomas and the New World Symphony in Making the Right Choices, a John Cage centennial celebration, a three-day festival programmed and curated by Michael Tilson Thomas that honored Cage's legacy by exploring 26 of the composer's rarely performed works for large orchestra and ensembles of varying sizes. Through theatrically immersive expressions of Cage's works, the program took advantage of the staging, lighting, and projection possibilities in the Frank Gehry-designed New World Center in Miami Beach. In addition to LaBarbera, guest collaborators for this amazing event included soprano Jessie Norman, vocalist Meredith Monk, pianist Marc-André Hamelin, dancers Brandon Coles and Andrea Weber, both former dancers with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, as well as dancers from the New World School for the Arts. Throughout the concerts and festival activities, audiences were able to explore John Cage's unique vision through videos, still images, projections of live and replayed performances, recordings of Cage reciting his own writings, exhibits, panel discussions, and more. I had the great pleasure of serving as festival advisor, so got to see and hear everything up close. And one of my very favorite of the scheduled events was a performance of Cage's Songbooks in a production directed by Yuval Sharon, the second half of an evening entitled John Cage Song and Dance, which took place on Saturday, February 9th, which starred none other than Tilson Thomas, LaBarbera, Monk, Norman, and Hamelin, along with a host of New World Symphony fellows, including Alexander Love, Anthony Parse, and Carl Baron. The technical and production staff key to the lavish technological exploitations of the New World Center included Daniel Hubb, stage designer, Jason H. Thompson, projection designer, Jesse Stiles, electronics, and Stefan de Wilde, lighting designer. Songbooks, Solos for Voice 3 to 92, is a collection of short works by John Cage, composed and compiled by the composer in 1970. It contains pieces of four kinds: songs, songs with electronics, directions for a theatrical performance, and directions for a theatrical performance with electronics. James Pritchett, who wrote the liner notes for much of the program booklet for the New World Symphony, summed up Songbooks as, quote, a piece that is impossible to characterize in any brief description, a piece that juxtaposes the old and the new, determinacy and indeterminacy, subtly crafted melodies of the Wonderful Widow of 18 Springs, and the galumphing cheers of the best form songs. The theatrical parts of the piece range from the ordinary to the inexplicable. Cage's description is as good as any. To consider the songbooks as a work of art is nearly impossible. Who would dare? It resembles a brothel, doesn't it? Joan LaBarbera is an internationally recognized vocalist and composer renowned for developing a unique vocabulary of experimental and extended vocal techniques, influencing generations of other composers and singers. She is well known in the world of John Cage, having performed his works for decades. She received the Foundation for Contemporary Art's John Cage Award in 2016. Among her many commissions for multiple voices, chamber ensemble, orchestra, interactive technology, and dance and film sound scores are Sesame Street Signing Alphabet for voice with live electronics, with animation by Steve Finken, which has been broadcast worldwide since 1977, and her collaboration with Johan Johansson for the feature film Arrival. Her multi-layered textual compositions premiered at Brisbane Biennale, Festival d'Automne à Paris, Warsaw Autumn, Merz Musik Berlin, among other international venues. LaBarbera was also artistic director of the multi-year Carnegie Hall series When Morty Met John, focusing on the music of John Cage, Morton Feldman, and the New York School. So welcome to All Things Cage, Joan. It's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you, Laura. It's great to be here. Great to see you.
I know. It's rare, isn't it?
Yeah. It's been a very weird 2.5 years.
I wanted to start by saying something to you that probably I've never said to you. Our relationship, yours and mine, is really simultaneous with my relationship with John Cage. That you were really present in the formative, weeks, months that I was with him. You have been in my musical sphere for as long as John Cage has been in my musical sphere, which is pretty amazing because you and I are almost the same age. So it's not like you're some, mentor, older person to me. You're really just a colleague. We've been together for a long time. I wanted to ask you a question, knowing as I do a bit about academia and being in that environment, that your life appears to have been, as a singer, your life has been extremely experimental. Your life has been really always looking for things that you didn't know how to do before and to figure those things out. I looked a little bit at your straight bio. You went to Syracuse University and then you did some training.
For three years.
And then you did some vocal training at Juilliard after that.
Yes. I transferred from Syracuse to NYU. And I had auditioned for Juilliard, but I didn't get in. But the teacher that I wanted to study with said, well, come and study with me, and I will get you in next year.
Marvelous. It's a good going in the back door.
Needless to say, I did not go to Juilliard, but I did study with her, Marion Zakeley Freshel, both at her home studio, which was on 72nd Street and West End Avenue, and at Juilliard, because she said to me, when you're done with your classes at NYU, just come up to Juilliard and you can watch me teach. And if one of my students doesn't show up, I'll give you another lesson. So I not only got to watch her teach, but I also got extra lessons, which was lovely.
Right. And you got to sort of you got to be coached by her in proximity to her coaching other people, which must have been quite wonderful. Yeah. So I guess when I was teaching, I taught for a while at ASU. I think you know that, ASU West, which was a kind of interdisciplinary campus in Arizona, unusual for Arizona because Arizona was not a particularly progressive place in any way, and certainly not educationally. But that school with Michael Cerveris was a little interesting because he was so devoted to Black Mountain and he saw what he was trying to do. He was from North Carolina, what he was trying to do at ASU West, a little bit like that. I always remember him when I was working with Cage, he asked me to ask Cage why Black Mountain failed, which I thought was a very funny question. And so I posed it to Cage and he said, that's a very funny question. And I said, I know. But what would you say to that? And he said, well, for heaven's sakes, Albers left.
Oh, okay.
So he took it as, why did Black Mountain not continue? And it was because the Grand Master, Albers, who was really that, left. But I wanted to ask you a particular question. And that is that in my own teaching, and I never taught in the way that you were taught, meaning that I wasn't teaching singers. I was really working more on theoretical ideas. I was working on critical theory. I was working on a lot of stuff like that. But I guess what I wanted to say is that we had an expression that we came upon, we might come upon a student and we would say they have a hair growing sideways. A way to describe a student who actually fit in more beautifully with the faculty and the faculty's ideas than the program itself.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I wonder, what was the climate like for you in at both at Syracuse and later when you were studying at Juilliard? You were so inclined toward that which you didn't know how to do. How many people were working in the same way as you?
Well, at the same time that I was at Syracuse, Phyllis Brynjolfsson was there as well. She's a year or two older than I. And so we got to be close friends, and she was studying with Helen Boatwright. And Helen was known as the Bach soprano, but she had also premiered Paul Hindemith's Das Marienleben. So she did both contemporary music of a sort, and very classical music. And my first year at Syracuse, I was studying with one of their regular faculty, but I was not very happy. And because Helen was the wife of the dean, she was not technically supposed to teach, but she had taken Phyllis as a private student. And she agreed to take me as a private student also. So starting in my second year, I was studying with her, and I studied with her for 2 years. And I did do some contemporary music of a sort. I did a work by Aaron Copland called In the Beginning, you know, wonderful piece. And I was the soloist in that piece. But I also had the opportunity to work on the Moog synthesizer, which Franklin Morris, who was one of the composers at Syracuse, had gotten for Syracuse. And, it was an early Moog, and you had to do a lot of patching and recording and working with tapes. And I had no idea what I was doing, of course, but I had a lot of fun. And it was up in this tower. So it was very, very strange. The Syracuse music school was in what they refer to as the castle. And it was some sort of castle of sorts, architecturally. So the synthesizer was up in this tower. But also what happened at Syracuse was I heard students experimenting with their instruments. And I was very, very intrigued with that. And also I was taking music courses with Franklin Morris, and one of them was a course devoted to contemporary music. So I did a lot of listening.
Uh-huh. And when you say instruments, I'm assuming you mean voice as well as instruments?
No, vocalists were not doing that. It was just instrumentalists who were doing it. Even Phyllis was not really experimenting with her instrument. She was, because she had perfect pitch. So she could do anything. Basically, she could sight read anything. And she did a lot of work with Gunther Schuller.
Uh-huh.
Opera work with Schuller, but not, I would not call it experimental work.
Right, because Schuller at that time was really working in jazz idioms, right? So that
he was working in what was referred to as third stream.
Right.
So it was sort of fusion between classical and jazz. Mm-hmm. But he had written an opera which I don't think would have fallen into that third stream.
I see.
Territory. And that's what Phyllis was working on with him.
Right.
But she also, you know, worked with Boulez, and as I said, she could sing anything.
Of course. I'm aware of her career. So I guess I was asking that in the sense, my mind immediately went to when you work in with anybody who's working with jazz and on one level or another, you're more inclined to experiment with your voice. Mm-hmm. Than, you know, jazz singers that, you know, scat singing and things like that, we're all sort of not taught in the way that classical techniques are taught.
Yeah, I think you're taught more by listening. Mm-hmm. In jazz. And once I transferred to NYU and I was also, studying classical voice with Marion Freschel, Madame Freschel, I started to again listen to instrumentalists who were experimenting. And eventually, actually, after that last year, which I had a year and a half at NYU to finish up because not all the credits transferred. But I sort of ran away from classical music and started doing my own experimenting. And I did some jazz, I did some rock, but I also was doing a lot of improvising.
Right. And you were also beginning to compose fairly early on, were you not?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I could actually say I had started that at Syracuse in working with the synthesizer.
Exactly.
So I was curious about that and had started that way. Yeah.
So in terms of the climate around you, your teachers were not averse to what you were doing, any experimentation that you were doing, they were fine with that. However, there were not a lot of other students doing this.
That's true. And actually, I don't know that any of my teachers actually knew that I was doing experimenting, because it was more outside of school. I will say one thing that Madame Freshel said was, you must work with composers, living composers, because they don't understand how to write for the voice.
Right.
And so that was an absolute directive.
Right.
Was very important to me. But I did more experimenting just at the edge of when I was graduating and then starting to work with various people. I worked with Garrett List and Alvin Curran. And with Garrett, I was basically trying to imitate the sound of the trombone. Just out of curiosity. And I would just ask him to play long tones and I would make a sound that I felt approximated the trombone. And then I would analyze how close I had gotten and then we'd go again. So it was really a very tedious kind of process.
going to say it sounds like fun.
Well, it was fun, but also because I was really determined to try to sound like the trombone, it was a lot of back and forth and trial and error.
And then
gradually started improvising with other musicians.
Did you have any colleagues, any vocalist colleagues?
Jay Clayton.
Oh, of course.
And Jay I knew because of her jazz singing. So once I started to dabble in jazz, I sort of listened to Jay a lot and analyzed her phrasing and basically sort of imitated her vocal delivery. For my work in jazz. And
it's harder than it looks.
It's much harder than it looks.
Because
you've got to do the tune, but then you also have to be able to go and improvise with the tune.
Of course.
So I did some jazz concerts. There was a place, I think it was called 74 Below. It was Trinity Church down by Wall Street. And they would do these noontime concerts for the people who worked at Wall Street. And a lot of it was jazz. And so they were very welcoming to have jazz ensembles come in. And so I did some concerts there. And so I was learning on the job, learning improvising. And also from imitating instruments, I got to know Michael Saul, S-A-H-L, who is a composer. He also was Judy Collins' music director and he played piano.
I thought I recognized his name from the pop world.
Yeah, from the pop world. And also he had a piece called Mitzvah for the Dead, which was, one of the big experimental type pieces. But he also did a lot of commercials. And so he invited me to do a commercial for a Japanese perfume. And they had already had a Japanese singer, but the ad agency people decided that she sounded too Japanese for American ears.
Of course.
Or too ethnic, And so they brought me in and they didn't really know what they wanted. So I started out imitating the sound of the koto, which of course was not a koto. It was a harp imitating the sound of the koto because the real koto was too ethnic, according to the ad agency people. So I was imitating the sound of a harp, imitating the sound of a koto, and ran this whole gamut of different vocal styles and everything, and eventually wound up with what I referred to as a kind of Astra Gilberto breathy Japanese-ish treatment of this. And around that same time, this was around 1970, Steve Reich was looking for singers who could imitate instruments. And Michael said, "Oh, I have the person for you." And I went and and worked with Steve and his tape loops, and then, you know, began to work with him on the development of drumming. And so I worked with him for 3 years. And actually, the funny story about when I first encountered Cage, which was in 1972, and Steve Reich and musicians were on tour in Europe, and Cage and Tudor were on tour in Europe at the same time. And so we would often wind up in the same places at different festivals. And we got to Berlin, and there was a performance of harpsichord in the Berlin Philharmonic Hall. And of course, you know, harpsichord, it was taking place all over the Philharmonic Hall. There was an orchestra playing in one room. There were slide projections of the moon landing and various other things on the walls. Back in the room with the orchestra, there were thousands of people milling around. And this was West Berlin, of course. And I found it very disconcerting. And there were people in the main lobby who were supposed to be playing electric keyboards or harpsichords or something. And some of them were, but some of them were just talking to the audience, which I found also upsetting. And I walked up to Cage, of course, I knew what he looked like. And I said to him, with all the chaos in the world, why do you make more? And the devotees around him just gasped. And I thought, oh, well, I'm not going to get an answer to this. And I turned and walked away. And a few minutes later, I felt this tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, and it was John. And he was smiling beatifically. And he said, perhaps when you go back into the world, it won't seem so chaotic anymore. And I know you've heard that story.
One way or another, yeah. I mean, I get
one way or another. Well, I told it when John was getting that award at the LA County Museum.
He was given the Weissman Award.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And it was a Liechtenstein.
It was yes. Yeah, a little. Yes. That's not going to carry on the radio. I just made a big arm gesture.
Gesture.
I can't remember, like a swoosh. It's almost like an animal.
A sort of swoosh. Yeah, yeah. Yes. I mean, Liechtenstein, it was one of his sort of cartoony things, but it had been made into a sculpture. Right. And I think someone told me that John had used it as a doorstop or something like that.
We still have it at the Cage Trust. If things get really lean, we might sell it.
But so we were at that dinner, and I was to present him with this award, and I told that story. And once we got back to the dinner table and I was sitting next to him, he said, you know, I've heard you tell that story so many times, but I don't remember it. So it was really meaningful to me, but it was, you know, I was just another person telling him weird things.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you're touching on something broader, and that is that he was constantly looking for his music to create a situation in which you learned something about yourself you didn't know, or pushed you to a kind of limit that you thought was immutable, and you found yourself on the other side of it, kind of thing. I think he was always looking for that.
I think that's a perfect explanation, because certainly it didn't change my mind about what I was experiencing, but it did certainly changed my mind about this person who sought me out, as I said, amongst thousands of people, and gave an answer to my question. And years later, when I was traveling with John, people would come up to him all the time and ask him questions. Nowhere near as insulting as mine had been, but more like, you know, Mr. Cage, could you look at this score and explain this to me? And he would always look at it, and he would look to see whether his instructions were there and were clear. And then he would point it out to the person. Well, this is the answer to that question. And if it wasn't there, he wrote it right into their score.
Nice.
He would correct it right there on the spot. And
well, you kind of answered a question I was going to ask you, I think just then, but let me make sure that I understood it. So I was going to ask you whether where Cage fit in your life direction, you know? And it sounds like Steve Reich fit in your life direction first, that you met him and he really nurtured something about you that you were interested in doing. He really helped you do that. People ask me, for example, every now and then somebody will ask a very cheeky question and they'll say, where do you think Merce would have ended up if he hadn't met John Cage?
Like, would he have
Well,
stayed on
first,
Broadway? Would he have gone into film and television? He loved, he loved Fred Astaire. He loved the popular world. He didn't know much about popular dance or popular music. But I remember one time, Joan, this is just a very silly little anecdote, but Merce and I were watching, we were just home one night and we were watching, as he put it, out of duty, we were watching the Paul Taylor PBS special. Do you remember that? It was, I think, I don't remember what the occasion was, but we were watching that because he said he should watch it. And whenever we weren't watching it, we channel flipped. And there were a couple of other things on. One was the movie Dirty Dancing with Patrick Swayze. And I remember turning that on and we watched it and he was quiet. And then he finally said, "Well, this is much more interesting than the Paul Taylor." But he also said about, I remember watching Michael Jackson with him once. It was probably Thriller, the music video. And he said something like, "He's very good, but he only knows one or two moves." And that's
Yes, that's
really
true.
true. When you looked at it from his eyes, it really was. He could do one or two things really beautifully, and he would play on those, but that was about it. He didn't push it. So I just wonder if Michael Jackson had met Merce Cunningham earlier, what would have happened to Michael Jackson, to have
That's an
somebody.
interesting question. Yeah. I mean, he was an incredible singer.
And a
Also,
dancer. He was an
and
amazing,
a
he
dancer,
could
and he
move.
very, very, very talented, very talented. Troubled, but very talented.
Where would you have been if you hadn't met Steve Reich? If you hadn't met someone who zeroed in on that which you were inclined to do anyway and helped you do that.
Well, it's an interesting question because roughly around the same time, I was also doing commercials with Charlie Morrow, and this jazz arranger composer Don Sebesky was looking for Ema Sumac and couldn't find her for some ridiculous reason. But he happened to know Charlie, and Charlie said, "Well, you should contact Joan." And so he did, and I went out to Rudy Van Gelder's studio. Rudy Van Gelder was a very, very famous recording engineer. He had a studio in New Jersey. I went out there, and all these tracks had already been laid down, and it was a song by Sebesky called Spanish Blood. And so he said, "Well, just improvise over it," which I did. And he loved it. He thought it was wonderful. I used a lot of my extended vocal techniques in what I was doing. And then I went off on tour with Steve Reich. I came back, and the album was out, and they had changed the name from Spanish Blood to The Rape of El Moro.
No.
Oh, yes. And the liner notes by Leonard Feather were all about, obviously, even if you didn't know the title, you would know what was going on. I was so offended. I was so furious. I was livid. I said, "How could you do this to Sebesky? How could you change the title of that and allow those liner notes to go on?" I said, "This is what I do. This is my music." And so, sort of answering your question, I was already dabbling in commercial music, as it were, and also did some other recordings with Jim Hall, the jazz guitarist, also working with Sebesky and Hubert Laws. But I think that attitude just so offended me that I thought, I don't want to have anything to do with this. I'm not Donna Summers. I'm discovering, I'm really working on trying to discover new sounds and just learn things, try things out.
So when you did meet John Cage, well, how familiar were you with Cage's music before you met him?
I knew some of it. I had experienced harpsichord. I had been to some of the concerts that John did with David Tudor in Europe. I certainly would have heard sonatas and interludes by that point in time. I
But his
don't
vocal
know.
works were not really known to you.
Oh, I think so. And the next time that I encountered John was at Phil Niblock's loft, and he was there I think with MERS for a concert. I don't remember whose concert it was, but I was about to premiere my compositions. This was 1974, and I was about to premiere my voice piece, One Note Internal Resonance Investigation at St. Mark's Church, one of their Monday concerts. And I was also doing it other places. And so I scribbled on a piece of paper where I was doing these concerts, and I went up to Cage and I said, I introduced myself and I said, I'm Joan LaBarbera. I'm doing some concerts of my music and I'd like you to be there. And he took the piece of paper and he said, oh, of course, of course. And so he did. He didn't get to St. Mark's, but he got to this place on Lower Green Street. I think it was called Enveron. And I was doing voice piece, One Note Internal Resonance Investigation. And I saw him out in the audience as I was singing. And I had this experience of like starting to rise up out of my head. probably because I was really nervous. And I said to myself, get yourself back into your body because John Cage is out there. You just can't leave your body right now.
That's so right. That's right. You want him to hear you. You want him to hear you.
And so afterwards, he came up and he said, that was marvelous. One of his most favorite words, I think. And he said, would you like to work with me? And I said, of course. And he handed me the score to Solar for Voice 45 from the songbooks.
Nice.
He came prepared. And Alvin Lucier claims that he talked to Cage about me. And he said that you really have to meet this woman because she's doing something very, very different with her voice. And she's able to do all sorts of things and she's really interested in this work.
Right.
And so I think that may have also been why he was so prepared with the score.
Yeah. Well, you know, Joan, in my own modest experience, way back then, we're talking, you and I met probably in the early 80s, is my guess, in Los Angeles, I'm sure it was. That was, Mark Swed was there, Julie Lazar. There was this little coterie of people. And I remember you there. But all I was going to say is that Cage must have heard in you someone who could actually bring something to his vocal works that wasn't being brought to his vocal works.
Yeah, I think that's why he brought me that particular piece, the Solar for Voice 45, because first of all, it required a lot of work on my part to make all the choices, to learn to do them as a vocalese. And it took me 6 months to do all the work. And finally, I called him. I said, okay, I'm ready for you to hear it. And he came over to my loft. I was living on Green Street at that time. And I sang it for him. And he said, it's marvelous, but it's not as fast as possible. Uh-huh. And it literally took my breath away. I said, what do you mean? He said, I mean it like calligraphic gestures, like birdsong. So, and that's 10 pitches. And I said, okay. And I went back to work. And sometime later, I said to David Tudor, I was sort of complaining. I said, I don't think he was clear. David said, show me the score. And I showed it to him. He said, here it is. Learn to sing it as fast as possible. You weren't singing it as fast as possible. So, and that, of course, was the first work that I performed with John at the La Rochelle Festival, July 3rd. 73, I think it was. Uh-huh. That had been the American Bicentennial year. No, 76. 76, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I can remember John and Greta Sultan and I took the same plane over to Paris. And then we had to change planes because we had landed in one airport and had to get to Orly, I think it was, to get a local down to La Rochelle. And our plane was late. And we were driven in this car right out onto the tarmac and ran up the stairs of this plane. And there were, people sitting there really pissed because they'd been waiting for these Americans to get there. And we were laughing hysterically. But it was just, it was amazing. And we got to La Rochelle and they were, of course, celebrating the American Bicentennial with Cage. And he had arranged to have this performance for 2 hours and 40 minutes of Atlas Eclipticalis. and two pianos playing winter music and solo for voice 45 from the songbooks, simultaneous. And 2 hours and 40 minutes was arrived at by a chance operation. And he gave this beautiful talk to the orchestra. And he had had trouble with this orchestra before. It was the orchestra from The Hague.
And this is the cheap imitation orchestra. They were the orchestra that wanted to be conducted, that couldn't do it unconducted.
And so Richard Dufalo was there, and he was the clock, the conductor clock. But anyway, Cage gives this beautiful, beautiful talk about how, you know, what distinguishes humans from lower animals is that we have the ability to take on a task and to do it to the best of our ability. And I was just so touched and so impressed. And I thought, oh, it's going to be a wonderful performance. It's going to be marvelous. Well, he also had arranged, because it was one of the hottest, driest summers in Europe, for two refrigerators to be placed in the wings with some cool drinks in them. And he said to the orchestra, if you have a long rest in your part, a long silence, you may quietly leave the stage and get something cool to drink and come back. Well, that was a recipe for disaster. And of course, the orchestra had been rearranged. And so directly in front of Richard Dufalo, the conductor, was this oboe player who walked on stage carrying two bottles of wine and his oboe. He put his oboe in the onstage stand, never picked it up, and just drank the wine for 2 hours and 40 minutes, offering, you know, cups to different players and everything. I would say about 60% of the orchestra behaved really badly.
Talking
to each other, you know, not playing their instruments, or if they did, they did something silly. And about, you know, 30-40% tried to do their work. And of course, I was just, you know, singing my bird song of solo for 45. And the pianists, Richard Bernas was one of them, and I don't remember the other one. At the end, you know, the audience erupted in, you know, screaming and shouting, and John was just surrounded by these French journalists and journalists from all over the world, you know, sticking microphones in his face. But when he was done with the German, he was purple with rage. He was just so furious. But he came up to me afterwards and he said, "You were marvelous. You just did your job." And he said, "I want you to know I'm with you always now."
The thing that you're talking about, John, was the thing that touched his heart the most from performers is trying their best to do something. You know, that was the thing that warmed him and drew him to people. It wasn't necessarily a great performance the first time. It was the desire to learn how to do this well, you know.
And to keep trying, you know, to keep working at it and doing it hopefully better all the time.
Right. Yeah. Joan, when were you with Mort? So Joan is the partner, longtime partner of Mort and Sobotnick. When did you and Mort get together?
We met actually when John took me out to CalArts in the fall. I think it was maybe September of 1976, right after the La Rochelle performance. And Nick England, who was the dean of the School of Music, invited John, and he said, "Well, I'm busy." He said, "If you love my music, you would let me stay home and write my music." but he said, "If you insist on my coming out there," he said, "I will come if you bring Joan LaBarbera." And so I went out and we did, again, solo for voice 45 with winter music for 20 pianos.
Wow.
Main gallery of CalArts on, you know, the balcony above and down below. And it was really extraordinary. Morty Feldman was there at the same time and he was snoring during the concert. But it was wonderful. That's when I actually met Mort. But he was at that time married to his second wife, and I was living with someone else at the time. And so Doreen Nelson.
Yeah.
And I'm the third wife. What I remember about him, because I knew, of course, about Silver Apples of the Moon, I remember thinking that he was shorter than I had imagined the composer of Silver Apples on the Moon would be. But then the following year, 77, he visited me in New York, and he would always invite composers out to take his place and do teaching for him when he would go out on tour. And so he invited me out there, you know, to teach his classes. This was 1977, and I was very happy to do it. So I was, you know, teaching them all about my extended techniques and the kind of work I was doing with various composers. And at the end of the 2 weeks, he came back from his tour and he said, "Oh, I always invite the composers out to dinner, you know, at the end of their stay." And so I drove down to his apartment at Santa Monica, and I got there. He was on the phone, and he said, "Come in, sit down." And I was listening to this one-way conversation, and he was talking to, as I learned later, he was talking to his son, and his son was about to go off on a camping trip with his roommate, who was a guy, and the roommate had just professed his love. And Stephen said to Mort, what do I do? I learned later. And Mort said, "Well, what would you do if it was a girl?" And he said, "Well, you know, if I didn't like her, I would, you know, say, I'm just not interested." He said, "Well, you know, that, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but
yeah, of course,
I fell in love. I fell in love with the incredible understanding and compassion and humanity of this person. That was not an easy conversation to have.
In 1977 or whatever it was.
In 1977, and his son was 21. And you know, this was, he was dealing with his roommate. So anyway, we did go to dinner. We went to this Japanese restaurant, and afterwards we walked, it was Santa Monica, so we walked on the beach a little bit, and the waves were like phosphorescent. And I thought this was like some wonderful symbol. And I told a friend of mine afterwards, he said, "We just had a storm. It was just the algae." But anyway,
you said it was my energy.
Yeah. My algae, anyway.
Right.
But yeah, and we got together at that time. I recall I had to make phone calls to three boyfriends and just call things off. And I went back home, and I think several weeks later I called him up. We had been, you know, communicating and everything, and I said, I'm coming out next week, and I'm coming with my cats, and I'm moving in with you. That probably took his breath away. But I did, and I moved in with Mort and his daughter, who was 16, who had one cat, and I had come with two cats. And she said to Mort, "She has two cats. I need another cat." Then we were in this apartment with four cats. Uh-huh. And not long after that, I found out that I had been awarded the DAAD residency in West Berlin. This was for the year 1979. So this was 78 by the time I moved in. It took a little longer than a few months. But I had a, you know, a big decision to make at that point, and I decided that if the relationship was worth anything, it would withstand my being away. And
what was the DAAD? What was the duration of that?
A year.
Okay.
Yeah. And for me, I was taking it a calendar year. Uh-huh. So I went in January and stayed the whole year. I did a lot of traveling in Europe and also in the States, which was acceptable to them. But basically the DAAD, all they required you to do was to live and work in the city and participate in the artistic environment of the city. It was a dream, as you probably heard from a lot of people who had that particular grant. And Mort came over in June, I believe it was, with his daughter, who had just graduated from high school. And, you know, she had big dreams. She was going to, you know, study German and all this. She lasted 2 weeks. West Berlin was not easy. You know, some artists got there, arrived at the airport, and got back on the plane and left. They just couldn't deal with it. I mean, you know, the wall was up. It was the time of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And I during my time there, I wrote this piece called Berliner Träume, Berlin Dreaming. And it included in it a sound of a sonic boom, because the Russian or East German planes, fighter planes, would just come over and break the sound barrier just to remind us that anytime they wanted, they could just wipe us all out. So it was stressful, and Mort referred to it as a minimum security prison full of artists. But the wall was around there. We did take trips. We could drive, which was really ridiculous. The East German roads were horrible at that point. And you had to drive in the right lane. You couldn't drive in the left lane, which was fine. And if you went out into the left lane, very soon a police car would come up and direct you back into the potholed, pockmarked roads. Right. And we got on a train one time. We were going to, I think we were going to either Stockholm or Copenhagen. But we got on the train at the Zoo station, and, you know, we were late. Of course, I'm always late to trains. And we got on the wrong compartment. You know, there would be on the side of the train the destination of the train, and you're supposed to know and get on the right train. And so we got on the train. We thought, well, we'll just get on the right one next stop. Well, we couldn't, because the next stop was East Berlin. And they actually put chains around the cars, and the East Berlin guards had these sticks with mirrors on them, and they would put them underneath the train cars to see if anybody was hanging on the underside of the train car trying to get out of East Berlin. So we wound up, the reason I didn't know whether it was Stockholm or Copenhagen is because we wound up in the wrong place.
Right.
I think we wound up in Stockholm. We were supposed to be in Copenhagen, so we had to take a ferry across. But I mean, these are just, you know, the wonderful, strange stories life at that time. So
it's true. But so you were with Mort from that day forward, from that period forward?
Yes, we actually got married in West Berlin.
Uh-huh.
The end of my stipend year, they call it.
I see. And when was Jacob born?
Jacob was born in 1984. Yeah, no, I had actually three miscarriages before I had Jacob, which was,
So he was a little miracle.
He was a miracle, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Uh-huh. And I remember you doing Jacob's room,
mm-hmm.
at mm-hmm. Betty Freeman's salon. That was the first time I ever heard it. It was so extraordinary. Yeah. It was just an extraordinary piece.
Yeah, with Kronos Quartet.
Yeah, exactly. And Jacob couldn't have been more than what, 4 or 5 years old at that time? Maybe a little bit older than that, 10 maybe.
Well, let's see. He was born in 84, and Mort was writing the piece. I think we premiered it in 85, if I'm not mistaken.
Not
so he would have been three.
Right.
Not at Betty. No.
No, I was trying to figure out where Jacob was when I first heard that piece.
Yeah. Let's see. I don't know. Do you remember when it was?
I can look this up. I won't do it now, but just out of curiosity, I'm going to look it up because I have all the records from the musicals, so I can look up when you guys did it.
Oh, that's lovely. You've got them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know when we did New Music America in LA, that was
86,
84. Right.
Okay.
85.
It was right in the middle.
Jacob was a baby, uh-huh. at that point. Because I remember Carl Stone came to the hospital after I'd given birth to Jacob, because we were still writing grant applications.
Right.
That was 84. It's a wonderful video from the festival, you know, a compilation of various things. And Jacob is there in this funny little red jumpsuit, and he's plops himself down there and he's listening. And
That's right. You know, Joan, I had forgotten just until this minute that you and Carl were co-directors of New
Yes,
Music
we were.
America that year. That's right. I had
Yes.
totally forgotten that. We used to,
right.
you and I and Carl and many other people sat around a table and ate muffins that I picked up on my way in from the West Side. God, I think I put on like 3 pounds that summer.
But what an incredible festival that was.
It was really wonderful and a particularly wonderful festival. It's true.
Yeah. And managing to get the LA Philharmonic to participate, you know, Ernest Fleischmann was, you know, the sort of demon monster controller of the LA Philharmonic. And he really got behind the festival and definitely supported
you, were
it.
You close to Betty at that time? Or did that all kind of come about after you participated in the musicale? Were you friends before?
We were friends, yeah. And I don't recall exactly how that came about. Well, living in LA, of course, you would get to know Betty. But she was friends with Mort. Just trying to think, because I was... In 81, well, 76, I probably would have met her when I came out with Cage, because Betty was supporting Cage. Uh-huh. And so she would have come to the concerts that I did at CalArts.
Right. Makes
yeah,
perfect
so
sense.
I think I probably, you know, met her in 76.
So you have had this extraordinary career doing some of, you know, some of the music of some of the most amazing composers of the 20th century back then, you know. Who else was among your favorites?
Morty Feldman.
Yeah.
Morty
a
Feldman.
A lot of Feldman. Who else?
Who wrote Three Voices for me.
That's right.
Alvin Lucier, with whom I worked for many years, starting in, I think, maybe 1973.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Yeah.
It was very sad when he died. There was a great deal of outpouring from people about him.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, he worked right up to very, very close to the end. Mm-hmm. And he was very connected to Issue Project Room.
Right.
And we did, you know, I am sitting in a room. We did this like mega performance for his 90th birthday. Mm-hmm. You know, to do a fundraising thing for Issue Project Room. And
right.
So, yeah, I worked with Alvin for many years, and Robert Ashley and David Behrman.
Of course, David. You know, Robert Ashley, you know, from where I sit, one of the unsung heroes of the 20th century. I don't think he's had his day yet.
Not yet, but it's getting there. You know, now that there's a new generation of younger singers who are working with Mimi Johnson to put on some of Robert's works. And we did a production of Dust at the New School in 2017, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that it had done in an academic situation. And I was the music director of that. So I got to coach the singers and in that production. And it was wonderful. It was a real labor of love, you know, to explain to them the vocal delivery, and because there's very little notated. Robert really depended on the people who were working with him. He would give us tone centers, but basically each singer created his or her own line.
I see.
Because he wanted us to develop the character through the actual music, the delivery of the word.
You have had also a very, very distinguished career with Michael Tilson Thomas, who's one of my heroes in life. I remember you kind of ever present when Michael was really rising. And you know, I don't know that this has changed. I don't want to cubbyhole him, but he hated the music of Robert Ashley. Hated it. He thought it wasn't music. He said, that's not music. You know, it's something else.
Well, chacun a son goût, right?
Absolutely. You know, but and, you know, we're going to have to close, believe it or not. We've missed 50 minutes like that.
Oh my God.
Know, it's amazing, isn't it? But I have to tell you that really, I talk about this in your introduction, that really one of my most memorable performances of yours has to do with the Making the Right Choices, the Cage Festival in 2013. That was really extraordinary. The three of you, Meredith Monk, Jesse Norman, it was beyond beautiful. And the staging, all of it.
Yeah. Very, very wonderful. That the Miami Festival, and also all the work that we did with the San Francisco Symphony on the songbooks. Yeah,
that's
making
right,
the right
that's
speech. Yeah,
Michael was always a big fan of yours. You and Meredith, you held this place in his heart. Anyway, that festival was beautiful. But you, the women around him for those performances, the songbooks. In particular, the songbooks were just gorgeous. I mean, it was gorgeous. And you also did you not, or Aria? You didn't do it there.
I didn't do Aria there. Meredith did Aria there.
That's right.
I did.
That's right.
I did She Is Asleep
Marc-André
Hamelin.
That's right.
Which was
a wonderful pianist.
Yes.
He's the only person that can play Music of Changes and make it, to me, I get it. The first time I ever heard him play Music of Changes, I said, oh, that's Music of Changes. Anyway, it was just such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful festival. And that had everything to do with you and Jesse and Meredith being there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Michael, I think, had a deep appreciation for what you could do. I'm talking about you personally. He just, he would program around what you could do so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been nice to have had a colleague like that who...
Definitely, yes. Yeah. And also Michael and Yuval Sharon really trusted my judgment about songbooks. And Yuval especially would come up with some of these outrageous ideas. And I'd say, show me in the score where that is justified. If you can justify it in the score, then you can do it. And if you can't, then that's not part of the music. That's not what
you sound written. Like me as a teacher with these kids who have some goofy idea. And I say, why? Give me a good reason why you want to do that. You know?
Right.
And
right.
There rarely is one. Rarely. But I loved Yuval's work. I thought he did beautifully. Did you go out to LA and see your operas 1 and 2? In the film studio?
No, I didn't see them, no.
Special. We're going to have to stop, but thank you for being with us.
Delighted to be here, okay.
Marvelous. We began tonight's program with Joan's performance of one of the solos for voice from John Cage's songbooks, number 49, from the CD from New Albion, NA-035 CD, put out in 1990. Now let's listen to one more of the solos, number 67, from the same CD.
There you go.